organizational. I think we all know that you can only do as much as the culture allows. I'm writing a book now, and it's been so cathartic to hear that, one, we're all not alone. There's a lot of first responders in this country who want more support, who need more support, who have sacrificed so much. Any industry, any profession, we all are going to be knocked down. It's a fact of life. I sat in my police car crying many times. I sat in my locker crying. Because I didn't understand the betrayal. I didn't understand. And we're wise enough to know in the 21st century, hey, I'm not going to go work there if it's that toxic. And these are the things that people are talking about. I don't want cops to leave. I want them to stay. And they can stay, and we can also bring better cops in, or more cops in, by creating better cultures.
Welcome to this episode of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with motivational speaker and author Chad Michael Bruckner about leadership, culture, and wellness, the answer to fixed recruitment. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Chad after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis, while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilient strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by Chad Bruckner, who's a motivational speaker and leadership guru. Chad's a retired police officer and combat veteran. Chad speaks on his mess to success journey and inspires people to tackle their own demons. Chad, really happy to welcome you to Respond to Resilience.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's nice to finally meet you. I like that mess to success. There couldn't be a better phrase to say.
Isn't Bonnie, isn't that all of us? I mean, isn't every human life have some messy stuff in it? So I feel like we could all relate to that.
For sure. Well, we would love to just jump right in with you. Can you give us some flavor and background on some of the challenges and setbacks that you had, maybe the messes, so to speak, in the Army, and then as a detective and as an officer?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think if you all know from being in this line of work in this field, it's just you're bound to run into trauma. You're bound to run into bad things. And when I was in the Army, I went in at 17, you know, at 1998, nobody tells you about, hey, you're going to see some things that are going to change your brain. And I was only 17 and my brain is still forming. So, you know, we didn't talk about that back then. They were constructing soldiers to kill or capture the enemy. And that's what we have to do in the military. So I understand the mission, and we're doing a much better job of preparing now. So going through combat and training and doing different things that, again, not understanding kind of how we perceive events and trauma, and, you know, witnessing dead bodies and you know, mutilation, or just abuse kids in police work, anything that changes us over time, and it's okay. So being in those situations, it was tough for me, because back then we weren't really getting a lot of that information, and it was starting to come out. And I remember we came back from Iraq, they did a 2-week where they put us on the Fort Dix, and they demob us basically. And they just wanted to run us through tests and things like that. And I remember thinking, like, why are they doing all that? Oh, to make sure that we're okay to return to society. So that was 2005. So these were, you know, beginning back then, but still not to where we're at today. So I found myself not responding well to trauma and stress, especially stress, and started having unhealthy coping strategies, like using alcohol, sometimes even using drugs and self-medicate. That's how bad I was. That's how much stress I was feeling. And, it was the shame of not ever wanting to do those things. Yet I found myself wanting to do them, to self-medicate and get back in the fight. That's that shame, I think, at least for me, that I carried with me so much. And it was, you know, working through that and learning to embrace it and understand it, not be afraid of it, and understanding that the more we embrace the pain and the shame, and the actually more resilient we become. So that when I started to realize that about 4 years ago, that's when I was full speed ahead to everything I've ever done wrong, everything that I'm ever ashamed of, to embrace it, confront it in dark hallways and see where this leads me. And it's created so much momentum for me that I want to help other people realize that our messes aren't the final chapter. They're not the final destination. And if we look at ourselves in these messes when we're down, we can take anything out of context. We see this in police videos or first responders camera videos that we take all this stuff out of context. But if you would see me when I was getting an ovation at in Hershey when I was doing a presentation in March, and guys, you know, in the front row were crying, I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And I wasn't even planning to do that. So it was a lesson of, if you saw me in my foyer, in my boxers, holding a bottle in my hand, wondering what went wrong 4 years ago, if you judge me on that moment, and all of us have been in that situation, yeah, I think it's messy and it's, oh man, not good, not good. But we all have moments where we rise. And I think if we focus on the rise and we focus on the positive, we always are going to have negative, every one of us. So that helped me with the messy success of pushing through. There's going to be more problems that come in my life, more challenges, more obstacles, more people doing unkind things, more periods of low money. I mean, there's going to be so much of that that's going to still come. And building this resilience now is going to help me and hopefully all of us as we build our personal journey to weather the storms, weather the challenges.
And talking about the rise in some of the situations we find ourselves in, we have to make hard decisions. And I wanted to kind of look at your career, which, you know, from my perspective, having retired not too long ago, you have to make hard decisions sometimes to maybe leave the career that we love. And sometimes it's because the environment at work's not healthy, or we find a calling to serve the greater good. So in your case, what led you to decide to leave law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a real loaded question there, David. I love it, though, because this will be a long conversation, but that's okay, because that's what we're here. I never wanted to leave law enforcement. I was going to get my college degrees. I was building myself to be the next chief of police where I worked at. And that was kind of my goal, my ambition. And just I never wanted to be a chief to be authoritative. I had that experience in the military. So my having these perspectives and lived experiences, I want to come in and make an impact, a positive impact. But organizationally, I think we all know that you can only do as much as the chief executive. You can only do as much as the culture allows and permits. And if we create cultures, I came from a culture towards the end, it got very selfish, toxic. We used to, the chief would, when we had somebody out on injury, he would not be a leader. He would actually squeeze and he would force guys and change their schedules to make guys be the leaders and correct this one officer who he thought was kind of faking an injury. So that was just one example. There are things like that, inequitable treatment, seeing that the previous chiefs, you know, every organization, you're going to have cops that aren't the most aggressive or any teammates aren't the most collaborative. You know, that's any organization is going to have that. And that's okay. The former chief seemed to understand that when you have dissent or conflict, you got to work through it and you push it back. Then we had a toxic situation at the end where those kind of people were getting promoted and uplifted to chain of command positions and ancillary duties. And it just being a leadership guru, understanding culture and understanding that this is an unsustainable track. This will get worse before it gets better. It usually bottoms out. There's usually something bad that happens. And on the meantime, as I'm going through my own emotional mental health journey, I realized that for me to heal and to be the best version of myself for my family and myself, you know, I couldn't do it here. I couldn't do it at the organization I was in because it was toxic. I was unable to heal. I was unable to be healthy. And I use the drinking as a great example. And I'll just speak where I came from. You know, a lot of police cultures are, we use alcohol. We use alcohol. We talk about it at work. We get excited to go home and binge drink and get drunk and get effed up. And we talk about that at work. We're never going to be the best versions of ourselves ever if we need that to get through our cultures. If we need to do those things to survive and get through, we're never going to chart a course of significance. It's never going to happen because we're just trying to get through the day. And I think so many cops are doing that right now. I talked to them. I'm writing a book now. And it's been so cathartic to hear that, one, we're all not alone. There's a lot of first responders in this country who want more support, who need more support, who have sacrificed so much for the community. And then they are thrown under the bus, so to speak, by their leadership and by just the culture they're in. And sometimes it's not even intentional. Sometimes it's, I use this term, taking hostages. But we have unwell people in leadership positions that if they never dealt with their trauma, they're going to take hostages. It's just I'm not a psychologist, but, and Bonnie, you would know better than me, but, you know, unresolved trauma and people that are in tremendous amount of pain, you're going to hurt other people unless you're self-aware enough to fix on that. And that's basically what it is. I ended up at the end working for somebody that was completely unhealthy. I knew that. I recognized that. I'm like, well, unless he's accountable to this, then it's never going to get better. So I just had to make that decision. And David, it was the hardest decision of my life. Mm-hmm. Second, before that, it was proposing to my wife. That, and then I got that got leapfrogged by this experience.
Come on, check it.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Chad. Yes, toxic leadership happens. We've all seen it. We've all been a part of it. And it makes it so hard for the entire environment because you're right. They are playing out their trauma with you or their mother-father attachment issues with you. The other thing I'll say is that I noticed this both professionally and personally, but over first responders, one of the best traits that we all share, and David and I are in the bucket too, is that we're very loyal. We are very, very loyal and dependable. However, I have found that we are loyal to a fault because it leads people to overstay.
Mm,
it leads 100%. People like, right, when that gut kind of comes up about, oh, like maybe I should do this or move on to the next thing. People ignore it, push it away, avoid it, medicate that away. And, and then you end up in a situation where a lot of people do overstay. And then they're negative and happy and they're draining the organization and the environment that they once loved. And 100%. So it's very interesting. One of our biggest, I think, positives becomes a big negative. So I think the fact that you were able to look at that and say, okay, it's time. It's not an easy decision, but sometimes it has to be made.
You're so right. And I think when we're trying to heal, in addition to making really life-changing decisions, it can be really hard and challenging. And I was trying to literally navigate my mental and emotional health consciously and aware in an awareness and communicating to my wife and people in my inner circle. I'm trying to weave through this, knowing that I also have to make really hard decisions and be a father and a husband. It was really challenging for me. And I know I'm not the only one in those situations. A lot of people are. So, being able to heal. I think healing in first, and this is the motivation for my book, is I don't want cops to leave. I want them to stay.
Right.
And they can stay, and we can also bring better cops in or more cops in by creating better cultures. That way, I felt like the only way to heal, Bonnie and David, was for me to leave. Mm-hmm. Really was for me to leave, because where I was not a culture of trust and openness and inclusiveness and healing.
Let's segue into this because I think it's related, and I'd love to hear your definition of the term moral injury, and then how does it affect the well-being of law enforcement officers?
Yeah, moral injury. I learned about this. It's funny, coming from the military, I didn't know much about it at all. I'm a certified recovery specialist in Pennsylvania. So earlier this year, I went through that training. It was a month long and really intense. And I just learned a lot about recovery. I'm in recovery. And I learned a lot about how to best support people, and words mean things, and empathy and inclusion mean things to support things. And it just opened my mind to how bad we are in policing and first responders, probably in general, but I can only speak to policing of the moral injury, the things we see that may be not illegal, unethical, but they're immoral to us. They challenge our personal values. An example I'll say is leaders that police leaders that use seniority as a means to get ahead or to have a better life. A lot of police departments adopted seniority as I'm senior, so I get vacation off first, or I do all these things first. I get first crack at it, overtime, all these things. It creates such a bad it creates a dysfunctional environment. It's like being a parent and our kids are born. And the first day we tell them, this is about me. This isn't about you. I'm senior to you. I'm senior to you. So you will take care of me. You will serve me in the organization. This doesn't work that way. It's not leadership. Leadership is messy, and we're rolling up our sleeves. And if we're doing it right, we're losing. We're sacrificing so our people can gain and win. too many police executives are worried about their contract. I mean, I talk to them and they're fearful. They're operating from a place of stress, too much stress. Mm-hmm. They probably don't have a great foundation. Maybe they never worked on their trauma, maybe all of it combined. And it's just led to critically bad numbers at the recruitment. And it's really tied to that. We hear the media, we hear elected officials. Sure, they play a role. Absolutely. Everybody plays a role. But the fact of the matter is we have unhealthy cultures and we're wise enough to know in the 21st century, hey, I'm not going to go work there if it's that toxic. And these are the things that people are talking about. We never talked about it before. And the more public we're becoming, I think that is affecting the numbers. And I think that's a positive thing so we can make change.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering how you think the culture and your identity as an officer impacts you in your family life, in your personal life. You know, how did you take that identity to your family? So yeah, the shift work, the hours, the holidays away, those things definitely impact, right? Mm-hmm. I was wondering what other ways you noticed for yourself.
Yeah, alcohol for one. I was a very social drinker. I don't drink now, but very social events, weddings, weekends. And I remember when I first got hired in 2008, it might have been a year and a half in, so 09. My wife was pregnant with our first child and we're living in our first townhome and she was going up to bed and I was off the next, she's a school teacher. And I was off the next day being on shift work. And so I'm off the next day. She has to go to work. She goes to bed. I'm staying up to play Madden or MLB The Show or some game on PlayStation. And as she walks up the stairs, she looks down where I'm at in the foyer playing on the TV, the family room. And we had a loft and she sees a glass of iced tea and vodka on the floor sitting next to my chair. This is like a Tuesday night or Wednesday night in the middle of the week. And she goes, are you drinking? And I'm like, yeah, I'm drinking. Oh, is everything all right? Yeah, I'm just off tomorrow. This is what, you know, I'm a cop. This is what we do, you know? So that was the first inclination that it's funny. We talked about that recently of like, I don't drink during the week. I didn't drink on weekends, but somehow I felt desirable to have a cocktail, to make a drink. And by the way, that turned into two drinks that night. Fast forward many, many years later to when I was deciding to leave law enforcement and my wife says to me, I was drinking 4 or 5 double IPAs a day. And by the way, this was accepted. This is accepted. We talk about it at work, about going out and buying beers and getting, it's a very unhealthy thing. And I don't want cops to fall down this road where we just continue to self-medicate in unhealthy and maladaptive ways that we're not in the fight and best for our family. And my wife says to me, Chad, you're drinking a lot. I said, this is what we do. This is 2020, 2019, no, 21, I'm sorry. And I looked at her in my kitchen. I forget. This is what we do. I don't understand what you don't understand. It was just so broken, so toxic. That's how I was. And I went upstairs. I laid in my bed. And I came back down a couple minutes later and I apologized. I'm sorry. This is not what I thought about what I said. So it started to make the roads to heal myself. And that's when I realized, because I was still at the police department then, I'm never going to be able to do it while I work there. I just can't. I just continue to see too much selfishness every day. And we sit around and talk negative about other people. We don't give 100% at work. The effort, the community suffers when we don't give 100%. All these things are negative things. I just couldn't stay. I couldn't take it anymore. And it was time to leave and kind of refocus and heal. And I've done that. And it's been amazing to help cops do that now that I'm coaching.
Yeah. Well, love the fact that you found this this area to pay it forward and use your talents and abilities to help other people in the profession. And it sounds like, you know, a really important topic for you is recruitment and retention. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, what we can do to fix some of those problems? What are some of the solutions that you see?
Yeah, I think my book is going to be on leadership, culture and wellness. And I believe that with all three, we will get those numbers back and better than before. But without all three, we will continue down this road. The more leadership continues to point the fingers at elected officials and the media, the numbers will go down. The more we continue to have unhealthy cultures, the numbers will continue to go down. The more we don't prioritize officer wellness, the numbers will continue to go down. This is facts. People are asking questions. I've talked to many police recruits that are asking other officers where to work, not what to work or what profession. They already decided policing, where to work. Just like in the private sector. And the more I talk to prospective cops and cadets, I realize that a lot of them are hearing the rumors of the negative cultures and things that are going on in agencies. They're asking specific questions. Oh, I read an article about a toxic workplace, or I heard about this. And do you guys have this there? And it's like, whoa, police departments before, you're happy you showed up. You were happy to get a job. They didn't have to sit here and recruit you. Now chiefs with no numbers are kind of don't know what to do. And I talked to a chief last week. I said, go door to door if you have to. This is your community. Go door to door, introduce yourself with a friendly smile, say who you are, say what you're here for, and leave a business card. You do that, and you're consistent with it, I promise you, those cop applicants will show up to your doorstep. We continue to expect them to come to us. We have to meet them where they're at, and we're just not doing that. Although that is changing, and the change is slow, so we just got to keep doing it. We have to continue to meet them where they're at.
You know, I'm listening to what you're saying. That's so different from 20 years ago. The fact that someone would have access to this information, access to these articles, to think about betrayal trauma, moral injury, toxic environments, and to be able to make an educated decision for themselves about which department in their county is better. I mean, already, look how much progress in 20 years. It's so encouraging.
They're using their brain. It's inspiring. It is.
It's incredible. You know, I was thinking about shame and feelings of guilt, which pervade all branches of first responder and military folks. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that. How do you see that showing up in law enforcement? How did that show up for you?
This is a great topic, because I think if we can get through this, Bonnie, if we can collectively or individually get through our shame, I think that's like, that's just as a non-clinician, as just a lived experience person who's able to kind of convey these into thoughts and words, that is to me the fundamental, for me, the difference when I change is I started to attack my shame and embrace my shame. I think shame for us, if you treat somebody in an unkind way and you're not healthy yourself, you will run far away because of your shame of what you did to that person. If you have a cognitive or half a heart, which I think we all have good feelings about us, we're human beings, you recognize that maybe I wasn't the best thing to do. And instead of embracing that and making amends, we run from it. Or we do further unkind things because we assume that relationship's lost. Right. Generationally, culturally, we have broken relationships in policing. I like explain the only profession I can relate to. And I really think a lot of that is just shame. It's shame that we all do bad things. It's okay. Mm-hmm. The difference is, do we own them? Do we apologize? Do we understand the effects we have on other people? Do we say, do we acknowledge them? Hey, I'm sorry you did that. That was unkind and rough. I need to do some reflecting and think about that. I know this is deep level stuff, but we're going to have to think like this if we're going to change the profession to get cops to come back. Right. So we've all done bad things, every single one of us. And any human that's like, I never did anything, you know, that's just not true. And that's some of that shame we have to work through. Mm-hmm. It's okay. It is okay. Even if you committed a crime, it's okay. If you hurt somebody so bad that they had to leave your agency to heal, it's okay. It's okay. We can come back and we can survive this by embracing our shame, by talking, by engaging, and not running away. I think that makes it completely worse. And it's just going to drag this out longer and longer. Personal shame for me has held me back, and it's not doing it anymore. And it's just from being honest and vulnerable and talking about it, and also acknowledging that the things I did were not good, or the things that happened to me were not good. And it's okay. All that stuff's okay.
You know, what's interesting, this is just one more little question, and I don't know how you feel about answering it, but if you could sort of categorize with your own experience, how much of the percent of shame and guilt is associated with the calls and the actual police work, and how much of is it the relational issues in the department and the structure of command and how that's all set up?
I think it's more than that than anything, Bonnie. We just love, I mean, I read an article the other day about a police chief who was going off about recruitment and, you know, and blaming the community members even. Right. Like we can't do that. Everything we have in-house is how we're going to fix this from the out going in. It's like our marriage or our family. Yeah. You know, if we're not the best versions of our spouse, how can we possibly, and we don't have a great marriage or we're cheating on our spouse or whatever, for whatever reason, how can we think we're going to go into the world and have success when we're not even having home success at our home base? So, yeah, I think shame is really holding us back inside. And I think if we could just acknowledge, hey, I'm not the best leader. I don't have the most experience. I made a mistake. We can work through this stuff together. I just think a lot of chiefs are worried about their contracts. I talk to them. They're worried about their career and their families. I understand that. But there's a better way and there's a more collaborative way. And the schedule thing, I think it's interesting because I was talking about this recently, but how many police departments, I never really was aware of this, but how many agencies have to have so many different schedules? Mm-hmm. Detectives, patrol, admin, everybody's, and some are locked. Some can't see the others, you know, and it's just, it gets back to that transparency and distrust. We have to get back to trusting each other. When we trust each other, we can work together. If we can't trust each other, how can we possibly work together? I can't trust you. I don't know what you're really thinking and feeling. And as somebody that we need to have trust to do a job where we could possibly lose our life, I need to trust you. And if I can't, we got to work on it. And we got to talk about that. But that shame holds us back for sure.
No, I appreciate you answering that because David and I and Stacy, we see it on the podcast, you know, over and over we have guests and that's one thing that people report. And then when Stacy and I talk about what we're seeing in our offices, it's usually not the calls. It's everything to do with those relationships and the betrayals under the roof. And you wish that you could just shout that off the rooftops to every agency, like, hey, this is what we're seeing. The calls are terrible. And yes, sometimes they make us upset and we need to get some EMDR, but this other stuff is what's really sticking with people and wreaking havoc. So I appreciate you validating that.
Bonnie, that is the secret that the chiefs don't want you to know. They don't want the public to know.
Right.
The trauma is only a part of it.
Yeah.
It's only a part of it. How we treat each other inside our agencies has a huge to do with it. And you're a clinician, so I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Yeah. So one of the things that we just talked about recently has to do with the leaders, say below the chief executive level, who are, you know, basically supervising all the rank and file. And one of the things that we don't teach them to do, and I know I wasn't taught to do, was to take care of, you know, how to take care of our people mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I remember a guy who was already promoted before I was, and just as soon as I got promoted, he gave me this little nugget. He said, the hard part of the job is not doing the calls. The hard part of the job is going to be inside the firehouse. And I had no idea what he was talking about. A couple of months, 6 months into the promotion, I started to understand we know how to do the calls. We've been trained. We can do them, you know, almost like in our sleep sometimes, the routine calls. But when you get people and everyone's different and people coming in at different stages of their lives, different ages, different places within the department, within the seniority of the department, and they've got whatever they've got going on inside the department and at home, then your job is, that's where you're getting paid for, is to take care of those people. And we're not really teaching our leaders how to do that.
100%. I agree with you. The chief only can do so much. The chief executive can only do so much. Then you need to have strong leadership below them. And, you know, I'll speak to the agency I went in where, you know, we started to purposely, it seemed like, promote people who were not the most qualified. I didn't understand, not everyone, but it started to be kind of laughable. Like how was everybody that previously wasn't advancing because they probably aren't the most capable, but they're important part of our agency. But how do those people then start to rise up and get in these key positions? That's why I recognize, I'm like, well, we're surrounding ourselves now. We're insulating ourselves with more ineptitude. And if we're not going to train or develop or mentor, then it's going to get worse. I knew that. I recognize that it's going to get worse. So I and it has. So it's sad. It's sad when you see these things happening and they do.
Well, and I think what you're touching on is also when you have a leader who has narcissistic tendencies, they're going to be more clicky. They're going to want their people, the ones that support their poor behavior and who they can also extend their poor behavior through. And so I think that's why sometimes the handpicking goes on. I was very fortunate enough to be the leader of my EMS agency during COVID. And, you know, I felt like I trained for that since I was 17 years old, you know, coming up the ranks and learning as much as possible. But I'll tell you, one of the things that saved me the most was being a therapist, because there were a lot of things that I could see and wade through and say, okay, that has nothing to do with me. That has everything to do with, you know, this person's playing out their mother or father childhood trauma with me because I'm the authority figure, you know? So I think it helped me that I could see those things. But honestly, I don't know how. I mean, it's got to be so difficult when you can't necessarily see those things right away. You know, it's
It's triggering for me, Bonnie. It's triggering because it's triggering. It's okay because what you said is it's hard. It's hard because I committed myself 4 years ago to really studying human behavior and understand why this happened. And the more I studied, the more I learned, the more I understood that people take their hurt out on other people, that unresolved trauma and pain, all that stuff. You know, it helped me understand human behavior and it helped me push through it and wade through it and stuff that still happened. Listen to this story. I had somebody working with me, a retired police officer that I knew that was working for me in a part-time contract type of, base. And at the same time, he was bidding against me on another job that I didn't know. He didn't tell me about that. I found out from somebody else. Then I asked him about it. And it was like this lack of accountability, somebody I knew and worked with for a long time. So I had to cut that relationship off. And it's just clearly that something happened to that person where they thought that was acceptable behavior to work for somebody, a cop, and then bid secretly behind them. I guess that, you know, that something happened in that person's life. But I understood that. I understood now that it wasn't me, it was them. But I also understand if I let that person in my life, it will continue to happen again until they resolve their stuff. So I just cut them out, and I've been doing that. And it has created a lot of momentum. But the cops, and which is most of them, I can't tell you, Bonnie, I sat in my police car crying many times. I sat in my locker crying because I didn't understand the betrayal. I didn't understand. I literally didn't understand why somebody that I loved and had a close relationship with, how could they not be loyal back? Or how could they do things once they got to the next level up? I didn't understand. And that lack of understanding almost it wanted me to kill myself. It wanted me to take my life because I couldn't understand. And I was so upset that I couldn't understand. I was devastated about everything going on. And it was the lack of knowing things. So I committed myself to knowing things. Everything going forward now, I'm going to know. I'm going to learn. I'm going to study. I'm going to research. I'm going to talk. I'm going to listen. I'm going to learn. And then I'm going to know. And then I will speak. And these are things that are just really important for me. And I think all of us to work in these toxic environments to support each other, get as much information as we can and support each other.
When you retire, you're just another employee that's gone. In 10 years, you'll be, that's a good old what's his name.
And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost 3 decades.
There's a running joke that says that as you retire, you're forgotten about before you even leave the parking lot.
It wasn't that I was losing the passion for the job. I decided I want to go ahead and transition and start traveling and talking to groups of people.
I lost who I was. I didn't have any plans for the future. I sunk.
And we're always saving for a rainy day. And what ends up happening is you die and you never receive the benefit of you working so hard for so long.
It's as if you've lost a loved one. For me, there's a sadness there.
They really do become your second family.
I was a firefighter. That was always what I wanted to do. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you find yourself without an identity.
I would pass police cars and it was like somebody punched me in the stomach. Like I got sick because I missed it so bad.
When you say I'm a retired firefighter, people, they notice. And they're like, wow, man, that's incredible. And it provides an avenue for you to be impactful.
You also said it before, but when you work with people, you bond over life and death. You know, think of the work that we're all doing together. So when someone that you're doing that work with stabs you in the back and hurts you that way, just because I'm a therapist didn't mean that I was immune to that either. And I understand that feeling. And it's unfathomable because you see people helping patients and, you know, everything looks so great or they're helping in the community, right? And then there are these things that just happen that no one knows. And I understand, you know, you sit there and you just can't understand it sometimes because it feels personal, right? I guess what we're trying to get at is let's learn from the things we've been through and let's tell other people, hey, it really isn't you. You're just part of the game. You're just one of the pawns at the moment. And we don't want to feel that way. We don't want people to feel that way. But if they go in a little prepared, right, to, hey, when this happens, please listen to what we're saying, then I think people will just be better prepared for that.
Oh, I think that's great, Bonnie. I think setting the expectations, preparing the new police officers, I think is the way to go. It used to be you were happy to be there and they could treat you how they wanted to, kind of because you're making a good salary, right, at least where I worked at, and you wanted to be a cop. But that's changing now. And I think we need to really discuss this, what we're doing. So I think it's great that you guys are willing to have these conversations and put this out, because this is how we're going to change. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen because we continue and be consistently talking about it.
Well, let's jump into talking about your book, Chad, because I know that's got to be an interesting process. I'd love to hear more about like how you get it out of your mind and onto the page, and any other, you know, parts of the process that you've been experiencing, good or bad.
Yeah, man, it's been, What a journey, good and bad. I've been up till 2 a.m. a lot of nights, 3 a.m. Or I'd wake up, I go to bed at 11 and wake up at 4 and start writing, just based on what I'm feeling. You know, sometimes I feel like God's nudging me and waking me up. it's been such a cathartic process. I think I'm an artist at heart in a way. So I like to put things together and create things that mean something and have impact and value. So, and I think about just the mode of how, even not only the content, but how the mechanism for that. So that part has been really fun for me. I'm creative naturally. So being able to, I'll throw this out there. Nobody knows yet. I'm breaking the book into four acts because I love this, and almost like a film, but it's going to be by the seasons. The first act is fall. And that's where I kind of explain my upbringing. I was born in the fall and I kind of explain my roots. The second will be winter. And that's when we get into the darkness and the storms. Mm-hmm. And then spring is the seeds of growth. And then we end the book on summer in a very optimistic and positive thing, a message to send the reader off and make the change. But at the same time, I'm walking the readers through of leadership, culture, and wellness, and how they intertwine through my own personal storytelling and lessons. So I'm really excited to get it out. I'm nervous too. Because I want to make change. I want to inspire people, but I want them to realize that it starts with ourselves. It really starts with ourselves. We're never going to make the organizational change, leadership, culture, wellness, create things that make our people better if we're not well ourselves. So I think the biggest shock of the book probably will just be, or the biggest thing will be looking in the mirror and saying, man, he wrote this about me, didn't he? Or I need to make this change. You know, that's going to be the hardest part. And people are going to have to make that decision. Am I going to make the change, or am I going to carry further shame to read this book and to know my own experiences and other books out there, and knowing what I should do, but not doing it adds further shame. I want to help. So I opened the book actually with a chapter on shame, because I want to talk about, let's get this right out of the way. You are not a bad person. There's nothing wrong with you. We all have done bad things. I've done bad things, and I'm a man of God and a family man. It's human nature. So embracing that stuff, I think, goes a long way to understanding, oh, okay, I'm not a bad person. I can come back from this. Okay. It's really just a mindset shift.
Well, it sounds incredibly creative. I love how you parsed it out there, because that's what speaks to you. It's a really good metaphor, actually, for the growth that we see people go through when they come to therapy. Right? It's like you help them through the worst, the darkest hours, and then all of a sudden you see them blossom and the darkness starts to fade away. And it's a beautiful thing to witness. So I'm looking forward to getting a copy of that when it's all ready.
Oh, that's incredible.
And I think you're promoting self-awareness, which is the key to all this, right? It's like, that's where we all have to start in order to change and to see what role we play in life and in our relationships, whether they're at work or at home.
Yeah, absolutely. The self-awareness, I don't know. And it's funny, Bonnie, you mentioned narcissism earlier, because I studied a lot about narcissism and to know about the traits and mechanisms and self-awareness is a key trait for a narcissist. So if you lack self-awareness, how do you come back from that? I'm not sure you would know.
Well, yeah. And that's tied into the insecurity that ultimately exists in that person because of whatever happened in their childhood. Right. So it's interesting how all the topics you're talking about, they intertwine with each other.
Yeah. And so I what part of the wellness I go into ACEs and I actually put the ACE exam in the back of the book.
Good for you.
I want chiefs to understand that if you can fix your stuff, stuff as the chief executive. I only pick out chiefs because they're the chief executive. As the chief executive, they set the culture. It's not the media, not the public, not the elected body. They set the culture. That's just how organizations run. So as the chief executive, whoever that is, you know, you have to fix your stuff. You fix your stuff and you heal, it's going to affect everybody. Mm-hmm. What I like to say, Bonnie, and I don't know if you use this too, but let's say you work for a 30-man agency, 30-person agency. That chief executive is not in charge of 30 officers. Mm-hmm. That chief executive is in charge of 100 plus. Mm-hmm. Because they take that home to their families. They may, and that officer, right. If you do something unkind or unwell to them when they're down,
right.
Guess what they're going to do to their kids? The same thing, generally.
That's right.
And we continue to perpetuate the cycle generation after generation. So chief executives have to heal your stuff. You heal mm-hmm. your stuff and get better, not perfect, but just get better. Mm-hmm. That's going to trickle down through agencies and they're going to take home and right. be better people at home, stay in the fight longer, have less divorce, less dysfunction, less toxicity.
Wow. Great stuff.
Definitely Chad. Agree with that. Definitely.
Well, as we wrap up, anything you got going on in terms of speaking conferences, any release date for your book or other events you got going on, please share them with us.
Yeah, thank you. So the book should be done October 1st. The rough mm-hmm. manuscript, I'm trying to have that done July 1st. It's going to be rough, but this year, definitely before the holiday season. But I'm excited. I really am excited to get that out. It's a very serious thing for me. I mean, I know I joke around sometimes, but it is very serious. I mean, I take it very seriously and I have to work on being a little bit more laughable with it because that's what life is, fun and joking around. But this is life or death for me, this topic. It really mm-hmm. is. I thought about ending my life many times. So in this period of time when I was going through this, so it's very serious. I'm excited about that. I'm in Boston in 2 weeks, speaking at the Officer Wellness and Resilience Conference. Actually, it's in Portland, Maine. That's June 23rd and 24th. There's still tickets available for that. So it's amazing. I can actually send you the link afterwards if you want.
That's great.
And I'm working on some speaking gigs now for September on resilience. I have a keynote that I created, a 75-minute keynote called Emotional Warrior, and it's unwavering resilience in a broken world. And I haven't presented that one yet, but I'm negotiating out with some organizations. I'm really excited to get that one out because I think that's going to be on a human level, on an individual level, any industry, any profession. We all are going to be knocked down. It's a fact of life. Set that expectation. It's going to happen. So how can we build things to come back and be resilient? And I'm excited to get that out. Yeah.
Great. Good stuff. Well, I think I would love to hear you speak. I'm hoping you come to my part of the country one of these days. Mm-hmm. And I'll definitely come by and say hi, shake your hand, and love to hear what you have to say in the live setting. It has been a pleasure. How can people find you out there on social media, website, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I use Chad Michael Bruckner, my middle name, in honor of my father. I'm not that pretentious, but so I do that. So just search my name anywhere on all the social media platforms. You can find me there. I try to have a pretty much, as you know, most active on LinkedIn, but I'm trying to expand that more to Twitter and other ones, as I see some people don't use LinkedIn. And I have a website, motivate-change.com, motivate-change.com. And if you can go in there, check it out, pre-register for the book, connect with me. Like, I want to build a community. Let's connect mm-hmm. and build stuff that helps us, like you guys are doing, to recover and heal. We don't have to leave the job. We don't have to lose our family. We don't have all those negative things that we continue to see people around us go through.
Right.
Those are, to me, those are choices. They're hard choices, really, really, really critically hard decisions and choices, but it is a choice. You can come back. We have to make a decision. You don't know, not knowing how to do it is not the reason to say no. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's like going in recovery. I want to quit. I want to stop. I don't know how. Can you help me? That's all you got to do.
Well, what I want to say to you before we really wrap up is this was such a good balance of hitting all of the topics that are really hard to talk about, but we also hit some really good positive things. So it was a really good balance. And I appreciate that about you. And I can see that you're a very balanced individual, and Godspeed.
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you so much. Yeah. Balance is the key. And probably the biggest thing in the last 3 years for me is being able to take some of the stuff, the experiences I've been through, and they've been hard, and I have a lot of anger and emotions like anybody else, but being able to work through that, like you said, and understand that those things happened. They didn't go anywhere. I forgave. I'm very spiritual, and I forgave. I didn't forget. You can't forget, but I forgave. Cool. And it's that forgiveness that allowed me to kind of move into advocacy and be positive and have solutions, but still talk about the bad and the negative, because we can't not act like that didn't happen. So I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. And also, you guys are doing amazing work. I know we said this before we started recording, but seriously, your podcast, your show, it's going to grow bigger and bigger because you're consistent. You have a great approach to it, the style and method of what you do, the conversations. You have a good team. It's going to keep going if you stick with it. So thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. We're so glad you were able to join us today and wish you tons of success with the book. Be looking forward to hearing about the release.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Like and subscribe our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms. And check us out on respondertv.com, past episodes, and guest information. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.